You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of 8 lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Connection Between the Living and the Dead, Collected Works, Volume 168, translated by Aria Jackson. This is Lecture 2, entitled The Elements of Our Being Between Death and Rebirth, given in Kassel on February 18th, 1916. The times in which we live suggest powerfully to us how necessary it is for human beings to investigate the meaning of life on earth. But we will never understand the meaning of life on earth if we look only to what is happening in the sense world, because the deeper meaning of all that happens there comes to expression only when the spiritual aspect also comes to expression in the sensory. This is a difficult time of testing. And particularly those who are firmly and devotedly determined to hold to our cause must understand that its meaning will be revealed within our soul only when we raise ourselves up to what is expressed spiritually, even in the very difficult events taking place on the physical plane. In light of the fact that we look upon battlefields where in innumerable instances the gate of death opens, and in light of the thought that a great many of our friends have already left the physical plane, perhaps we will do well, particularly today, to turn our attention to what can be said about the world into which human beings enter when they step through the gate of death. Today we will examine the life between death and rebirth from this viewpoint. Of course, there are many viewpoints from which our approach may originate. In spiritual science, we try first of all to understand people as they are before us. We know that they stand before us in both their physical and spiritual aspects. We know that these spiritual aspects remain suprasensible. The spiritual can reveal, announce itself only through the physical. And when we observe human beings here on the physical plane, in order to understand them in the sense of spiritual science, 4 main parts or elements of the human being are initially unveiled to us. We call them the physical body, the etheric body, the astral body, and the I. You know this from my description in title Theosophy. Beginning with the etheric body, the elements of human nature are suprasensory to physical observation. But we do experience our own I and astral body. We experience them inwardly. We experience them in that we are able to know ourselves as I, even though this I remains hidden, suprasensory. And so you can understand why we consider human beings according to all of these 4 parts, even when we focus only on what the physical world reveals. Now let us consider the fact that we can also look at those who are living between death and rebirth in a similar way, that it is also possible to speak of the elements or members of one who is in the life between death and rebirth. Indeed, you know that we leave our physical body to the material elements, the substances of the earth, and we leave our etheric body to the universal etheric world. After a time, what is particularly present in our astral body, but of which we know nothing on earth, also dissolves, as it were, and our eye then continues through the world that we experience between death and rebirth. We should think of human beings who exist between death and rebirth as differentiated, structured beings, just as human beings are here in the physical world. We can also speak of the different parts or members of our human nature between death and rebirth, but in this case we will have to speak in the following way. When we observe human beings here on the physical plane, the I appears to us as what comes across to us as the highest aspect, if we may use the expression. Here, human beings have a physical body in common with all minerals, an etheric body with all plants, an astral body with all animals. But the I belongs to human beings only. In the spiritual world, the I, which on earth is the highest aspect of human nature, is the lowest aspect in the world between death and rebirth. As we begin with the physical body here, so must we begin with the I in the spiritual world, that's capital I. The I is the lowest part of the human being between death and rebirth, and is enveloped as in a mist by the astral aspect, while the individuality moves through the soul world. And just as we envelop ourselves here with the various members when we enter the physical world from the spiritual world through the gate of birth, so do we also, after death, envelop ourselves in the spiritual world, as it were, with spiritual members. We actually already know the names of these spiritual parts. It is just that we look at them a bit differently on earth. To begin with, we envelop ourselves in spirit self when we have passed through the gate of death. The spirit self is in fact a part of human nature that humans will develop in themselves in the future during the Jupiter stage of evolution. What I am now calling the spirit self for the world between death and rebirth is not exactly the same as what will develop when human beings evolve onward from Earth stage to Jupiter stage. What will develop during the Jupiter stage will be a sort of outer reflection, a counter-image appearing to the senses of the spiritual being that human beings take on when they pass through the time between death and rebirth. So we can also characterize this aspect in which human beings envelop themselves there when they pass through the time between death and rebirth as the spirit self. With further progression in the spiritual world, human beings envelop themselves in the part we can call life spirit, which is a spiritual counterpart to something that will develop in our physical progression only during the Venus stage of evolution. And the true spirit human will develop within human beings as the spiritual counterpart of what human beings will have as a physical reflection in the highest sphere of their physical evolution toward which we can look today, the Vulcan stage. Thus we can say that just as human beings envelop themselves in the astral, etheric, and physical bodies on Earth, so do they envelop themselves in the spirit self, life spirit, and spirit human, as they grow into the spiritual world. Now I would like to describe a bit more precisely, out of initiation knowledge, as one might put it, how these things come about. Indeed, you already know much of this. When human beings pass through the gate of death, the physical body is given over to the elements of the earth. This release of the physical body is extraordinarily important for the life between death and rebirth. And although it certainly seems trivial to say that death is actually birth in the spiritual world, even so it is accurate. We must simply become accustomed to making our concepts somewhat flexible, so that with our concepts we do not immediately cling to what the earth presents to us. We are used to forming our concepts only according to what the earth presents to us. We must be able to transform these concepts. Life in the spiritual world is completely different from life on earth. The spiritual experience that human beings have in the spiritual world by stepping through the gate of death is this. The physical body falls away. That is a meaningful and immensely meaningful experience. And the first thing that should be said about this experience is that it relates quite differently with respect to the beginning of the spiritual life after death than a person's birth relates to physical life between birth and death. We cannot observe our birth with earthly physical powers of perception. Human beings do not experience their birth here on earth with their physical powers of perception because we do not then have memory. Memory itself begins only later. This is proper for earthly life and must be so. But it is the opposite for the life between death and rebirth. Because the moment, the instant of death, I cannot say of dying, but the moment of death, remains as something the person can look at again and again during the whole progression of the life between death and rebirth. Though we do not remember the event of our physical birth, in contrast, we have the moment of death before us clearly throughout our entire life between death and rebirth. But from the other side, from the perspective of spiritual life, from the other shore, so to speak. Death can be fearful for human beings on earth, and this reaction has a certain rightfulness. It represents the decline of the physical nature of the human being. Exactly the opposite occurs when human beings between death and rebirth look back on their death. Then death continuously shows the triumph of the spirit over the physical. Death then represents the most beautiful, most splendid, most exalted thing that we can essentially ever experience. And being capable of observing our death throughout our entire spiritual life between death and rebirth gives us consciousness after death. We know that we have laid aside our physical body. Just as we gain our self-awareness here in the physical world by having a physical body, the fact that we experience our death and that we always have it before us gives us our self-awareness after death. When we are outside the physical body with the astral body and I, during the time between falling asleep and waking up, we have no consciousness of the physical world. When we awake, we must physically sink into ourselves, and then our I consciousness can blossom again. After death, each time we look at our death, when the whole event, this exalted, beautiful event as seen from the other side, stands before our soul, then consciousness awakens again and again after death. Consciousness completely depends on the continuous observation of this moment. Something else is connected to this as well. It is somewhat difficult to speak about these things because, as I said, there are no corresponding experiences here in the physical world. But we must try to characterize these things as they really are. If during our life after death we look back at our death, above all, we have the feeling and the ideational impression that where we died, from then on, there is nothing, not even space. Let me read that again. If during our life after death we look back at our death, above all, we have the feeling and the ideational impression that where we died, from then on, there is nothing, not even space. As I said, it is difficult to describe, but it is so. Nothing is there. And expressed in an outer way, the whole thing from its foundations appears splendid, exalted, because everywhere other than that place, a new world arises for us. The flooding spiritual world surges in from all sides, but nothing is there of the place where we died. To describe these things theoretically in this way might seem grim, but there is nothing grim after death about this perception. A deep fulfillment wells up in the soul from this perception after death. One learns to expand into the whole world and to look back upon something in the world that is as if empty. And from this arises the feeling, that is my place in the world. The place that is made of all the far expanses, and that is mine. And one has the perception that precisely from this emptiness one gains a sense of the meaning of the whole world, that every single human existence, one has it of course first as an explanation for oneself, must be there. Quote, this place would always be empty if I were not there. So each soul tells itself. The perception is that each one is given a place as a person in the universe. This perception, which is incredibly warming internally, arises from this observation. The whole world is there, and the whole world has sent forth as out of a symphony the single note that is the person. And this note must be there, or there would be no world. This feeling is what arises from looking back on our experience of death. It remains because it primarily gives the I consciousness, self-awareness, between death and rebirth. Then there is a comparatively short but sufficient time for a togetherness with the etheric body. For a number of days, everything one has experienced in life, even the smallest events, remain. It is all there, together, in a great life tableau. During this time, one has the very intense feeling that the earth on which one has stood keeps moving on, but one's own self remains behind. One begins to stand still. One no longer goes along with the spatial movement of the earth. And because of this, the life tableau spreads out. When we speak of this remembrance of life, we are not speaking of memory in the actual sense of when we have memories by looking back in time. That is not the case here. Rather, it is simultaneous. It is a tableau, a living tableau. And, as I mentioned before, it includes even the smallest events. Then one separates oneself from this etheric experience. The detaching of the etheric body takes place, as we say. One now has an outer form, what one had experienced inwardly with the etheric body. Let me try that again. One now has as an outer form what one had experienced inwardly with the etheric body. What was experienced inwardly is now outside of us and grows bigger and bigger and weaves itself. That is actually the correct expression. Into the spiritual world one has just entered. But in the spiritual world, the void emptiness of which I have spoken remains, and the etheric body weaves itself all around it externally and becomes bigger and bigger. Now, we must hold on to the fact that it would be an erroneous idea. I must admit that I have been convinced that in every case it would be a mistake to think that we could not see what we weave with the universal spiritual world as an etheric body during the life between death and rebirth. We see it eternally, see it continuously. It is part of our outside world. What was in the etheric body until now, what was part of our inner world, is now part of the world outside of us. We look at it. And it is important that we are able to look at it, because through it, so much of the outer spiritual world becomes understandable to us as a relationship between what we have woven into it and the entire outer spiritual world. You may remember the lectures I once gave in Vienna concerning the time between death and rebirth, when I said human beings are first of all interwoven in a world full of wisdom. Whereas here on earth we search, straining for wisdom, there we are completely surrounded by the light of wisdom. The wisdom with which we are surrounded overwhelms us there. And it would continue to overwhelm us if we could not weave into the world the wisdom we have taken into our etheric body during life on earth. What we bring dampens down the immense overabundance of light in the universal world ether. And we begin to understand what in the universal world ether weaves through the world and imbues it with soul and spirit. With this is described what falls away from us, so to speak, when we are taken into the spiritual world. Because essentially then, only the I and the astral body remain from the earthly parts of human nature. The physical body has fallen away. In its place, what I have called the void or emptiness remains. The etheric body is accepted into the universal world ether. We continue on our way. What we have now given to the world ether as our etheric body, we replace by enveloping ourselves in what we have called the spirit self. It is now more or less an outer member of our being. The undifferentiated etheric presses around us. It envelops us with a sort of spirit self. It would be good to spend a bit of time now on our concept of the human being. We need not talk about the void that remains, because it has great meaning only for those who have died, who have experienced it in the way that I have described. But it is somewhat different for the etheric body. The etheric body weaves objectively into the universal world ether. This human etheric body is now inside it. You will understand that to a certain extent the etheric body of a person who dies at a young age is somewhat different in the world outside than the etheric body of a person who has reached old age. Of course, every etheric body has its task, and to wish to die young or to die old should not result from what I will now say. That would be a distorted misconception, the greatest misconception of the matter. But nevertheless, what I have to say now is accurate. The etheric body of a person who dies at a young age could possibly have worked within the physical body and sustained the physical body for decades more. Energy in the spiritual world is not lost any more than it is in the physical world. That is, if the person dies at 20 or 30 years old, a force is present in the etheric body from which the person is released after death that could have sustained the person's physical body for decades more. This etheric force is no longer within a physical human body. It is outside, in the world. Perhaps this can best be understood with an example. I have already spoken to some of our friends about this subject. There was a young child who perished under tragic circumstances at the age of 7 near our building in Dornach. He had gotten some food that evening from our cafeteria, which is near the building. A strange chain of events resulted in the child's going out of the cafeteria and through some bulrushes that were near a road on which a fully loaded furniture truck was passing at that moment. The truck overturned and crushed the little boy. It was a very tragic event. Right after the evening of lectures, after 10 p.m., word came to us that the child was missing, so we searched for the boy. At first we could only see what happened to the furniture truck. The extenuating circumstances were also very strange. The boy had wanted to leave 15 minutes earlier, but was detained by someone who wanted to talk with him. And he had wanted to go through a different door, in which case he would have passed the furniture truck on the right side, whereas he was crushed on the left. Someone told him that he should go out through that particular door. He was directed, literally, to go out that door. And besides that, no furniture truck had driven on that road for years, and perhaps no truck will drive on it for years to come. It was a truck that was bringing furniture to one of our members just that one time. The furniture truck was so heavily laden and fell haplessly in such a way that it could not be immediately lifted. The people who were driving the furniture truck had nothing with them to lift it, and simply left. They wanted to wait until the next day to lift the truck, but of course we had to lift it that night, and we found the dead child underneath it. Thus, in the time after his death, this little boy had been in the surroundings of the building for a while. Now, it is really true that in the time after his death, his etheric body was interwoven into the building's aura. It is surely not immodest to say that whoever, like myself, is involved in the artistic aspect of the building notices how the stimulation one needs to integrate various things artistically into the building comes from this child's unused etheric force. Of course, it might be more congenial to human egotism to ascribe it all up to one's own ingenuity. But it is absolutely the case that what comes to us inwardly originates from outer spiritual influences. And we can concretely verify each of these spiritual influences. Here we are concerned with the boy's etheric body, which was 7 years old, and thus could have sustained the physical body 6 or 7 decades longer. It now exists in the etheric aura of the Dornach building, with the whole immensely wise constructive force necessary to artistically form the physical human body. And I even dare to say with complete certainty to artists that the art necessary to form the physical body from the etheric body is much greater than any art we practice on earth. Human beings are indeed the greatest artistic creation. And all the impulses that form the physical human body are contained within the etheric body. Artists as well produce impulses from their etheric body when they create artistically. This is just one example. Others can be given in which the supporting capacity of unspent etheric bodies can be seen. Even during this year, dear young friends of ours have passed through the gate of death. And so we see how, in precisely this time, countless people are passing through the gate of death at an early age, leaving their etheric bodies, which all could have worked on the physical bodies for decades to come. These etheric bodies, which in addition have been invigorated and strengthened by going through sacrificial death, are present and will be present. In future times, there will be people living on this European soil who will be able to live in a spiritual and etheric atmosphere where these unused etheric bodies exist. And when there are people on earth who understand what lives spiritually, not just as abstract memory, but as true etheric forces, we will be able to have this understanding only through spiritual science. Then they will no doubt feel the inspiring forces of what is present from these etheric bodies. And that is part of the feelings that now weigh heavily on our hearts. We say heavily because when we look at the enormity of what could happen if a good many people became aware of what is sown through the deaths that are now taking place around us in the great events of our time, we see that the number of people who can understand these things is still so small. And it could easily be that through people's lack of understanding regarding spiritual science, as a result of the materialism filling all humanity, people in the future could live on without any hint of an idea of what can come about as a result of these deaths. We must let such a statement live in our own hearts in no other way. Inasmuch as it is incumbent upon us, then that we fill ourselves with such a consciousness and do what we can to create an understanding of it. We should not just fill ourselves with the fearful worry of how much materialism exists. We must recognize how much materialism exists on earth, but we should not close ourselves off, for instance, to the materialistic worldview that is spreading more and more. Rather, we should do all the more to carry out our tasks. So much for what there is to say about the etheric physical aspect. In the spiritual world, after death, we human beings then advance another step. We first envelop ourselves in a sort of spirit self, which is formed in a slightly different way than all that is formed when we are here on earth. One could say that the spirit self is something that presses toward us from all sides, and we feel as if we were at its center. Then we settle further into the other members of our human nature by experiencing at the same time a sort of spiritual course moving backward, as I have described now and again. We experience a sort of antithesis to earthly life, but now in a much different way than through the pure tableau I described. We realize how subsequently time proceeds after the etheric body is put aside, and we live on with the astral body and the eye enveloped in the spirit self. This spirit self is a sort of driving force. It leads us back so that we experience our last earthly life in reverse, from death to birth. We really move backward. For example, here on earth, if we say something to a person and harm that person, we experience that event in our physical body from our own point of view. We cannot experience it from the standpoint of the other person. We would not be able to live in the physical body at all if we wanted to live otherwise than having our own experiences. Let us take a case in which, in order to get revenge, someone hurts a person very badly by saying something. Here, one does not experience what the other person feels or senses. With our going backward after death, which I just described, we experience in the spiritual world what the other felt, always as the effect of what we have done. That is, there, we live within the world of effects. We experience in reverse order what others have gone through with us during our physical life, completely separate from ourselves, until we come to the point where we have reached birth. Then we envelop ourselves with what one could now call the spiritual counterpart to what will develop during the Venus stage of evolution. We envelop ourselves with life spirit. And this life spirit determines later life, which I have also described before. You will, for instance, find it described from the most varied viewpoints, also in the Vienna Lecture Series on Life Between Death and Rebirth. Today I want to describe it here from another viewpoint. In the spiritual world, we are now surrounded by life spirit, and it expresses itself in a certain way, which is essential that we understand. The spirit self first leads us back. The spirit self mainly has to do with our essence, with our individuality. And then it leads us further on. After it has brought us back to re-experiencing birth, it leads us on to the paths we are to follow in the spiritual world. Our further envelopment by life spirit is different. Here in the physical body, we are permeated by the etheric body, which also contains life ether and all that enlivens us. We are more or less permeated by the etheric body, and we live through this etheric body. You know that the etheric body extends slightly beyond the physical body, but otherwise has a very simple shape. Without an etheric body, one cannot live on the physical plane. When we have put aside our astral body, we realize that we are enveloped in life spirit. We are enveloped by life spirit. The whole time, that spirit self was leading us back, but only now do we notice it. We notice it only after we have gone through the whole process called the Kamaloka period, and we now become aware of something interesting. Life between death and rebirth is possible only by being enveloped in this life spirit. Here, in the physical body, we must live within our skin, but we cannot live within ourselves in the spiritual world between death and rebirth. If we wanted to live only within ourselves in the spiritual world, more or less only in one single place in the spiritual world, then we would have to die perpetually. That is, we would not be able to live. Rather, we must live with the entire universe. We must know the whole universe to be a great living being with which we must live. Now, this can happen in two ways. We could flow out into the whole universe, but if we flowed out, the consciousness we would have, which I have described as self-awareness, would also flow into nebulousness. Rather, we must move around within the great living world organism. Here, in the physical body, an element of ourself, say a hand, is in a specific place. In the spiritual world, we must always be led around. We must always be carried from one place to another. The life spirit does that. That is how we leave one place and arrive at another. However, this happens rhythmically, so that we always return to the same place. But we must be led around in the spiritual world. A spiritually dynamic life develops for us. Here, as physical individuals, we are, for the most part, stuck in one single place. Something of the spiritual is always carried into the physical, and thus we are able to move around on the physical plane. This is essentially an Ahramanic effect, because the spiritual is carried into the physical by Ahraman. But after death, it is right that we are led into the spiritual through the whole associated world organism, and in this way, we settle into the whole environment surrounding earthly life, whereas here on earth we settle into one place. And while we are led around within this spirit environment after death, from spirit place to spirit place, you can find more details on this in my Vienna Lecture Series, at the same time the forces are implanted in us that we need to prepare for our new earthly life, to be drawn toward earthly life again. The first half of the life between death and rebirth proceeds in such a way that we make our way away from our former earthly life. In the second half, we find ourselves preparing for a new earthly life. You see, materialism today essentially creates the opposite out of all things. It misleads people to the worst misconceptions, making them seem not only credible, but almost obvious. When a genius appears, such as Goethe, people take him materialistically. A very thick book was written and published about Goethe, in which all of his ancestors who could be found through research were analyzed in a materialistic way, both physically and mentally, though the materialist looks only at the body. The authors showed how Goethe inherited this from one ancestor, that from the other. Goethe himself said, ironically, quote, "I have my stature from my father, my happy nature from my mother," close quote. Here in Kassel, during a lecture series, I once showed how people take so materialistically what is, in quotes, bequeathed through the stream of physical heredity, including genius in particular. And I have frequently said that this is absurd, laughably foolish, and yet again, so credible. It makes immediate sense to the materialists that certain characteristics are enhanced through many generations and then appear to be bequeathed to the genius. The materialists think that they are speaking of real experiences, but it expresses nothing more than, for instance, that someone who has fallen into the water and has been pulled out is wet. The soul naturally passes through all its ancestors in a certain way, and thus everything that it drew from those ancestors is attached to it. Just as someone who has fallen into water is wet, so too do we have the characteristics of our ancestors as we go through the generations. It would be different if the opposite occurred, if one could prove that genius is bequeathed to one's descendants, but it is not. People should prove that, but they leave that out. They research Goethe's ancestors, but then they neatly leave out his son and his grandchildren. Just look to see if the characteristics of being a genius are bequeathed to descendants. Although there may be cases where the matter is concealed, bequeathing the characteristics of genius to descendants is out of the question. Only if it would manifest, would one experience it. But there is no such bequeathing of the characteristic of being a genius. However, something else is the case. When we try to follow a human individuality further back, the individuality enters a physical body at a certain point in time. It comes from the spiritual world, after all. It is this same individuality that brings father and mother together, that plays a part in the father and mother coming together for its creation. Indeed, it plays a part even further back. It affects, more or less, the entire series of generations, in such an order that at last the two people, through whom this one individuality can find its embodiment, find each other. This individuality plays a part in all that takes place through centuries from ancestors to descendants. As unusual as it sounds, it is true. Goethe had a father and mother, grandfather and grandmother, and so on. If we go back through the centuries, we will see that Goethe's individuality had an effect from the spiritual world in such a way that people always found each other, so that finally the senior Caspar Goethe and his wife Aya were produced. The individuality of Goethe affected the series of generations over centuries from the spiritual world. This is exactly the opposite of what is assumed. What we human beings carry in our souls is not bequeathed to us physically by our ancestors. Rather, we assemble our ancestors from the spiritual world, from the cosmic midnight of the world, which lies at the midpoint between death and rebirth, so that we can find our way into earthly life. This is the mystery that results. This is immensely significant. And through it we see clearly that really an inner link exists between what happens in the spiritual world and what happens in the physical world. And at the same time we see how uniquely is our spiritual soul life between death and rebirth interwoven with what happens here. This is simply not noticed here. Recent philosophy speaks of spirit in a very strange way. There was a professor in Halle, now seen as a very important light in the field of philosophy, who published a book titled The Philosophy of As If, in which he tries to prove that such concepts as spirit and soul, do not represent reality, but that they are useful in humanity's worldview. He says that one should not look at human beings in such a way as to think that they have souls. They move their hands and speak, so we can say that we behold them as if they had souls. Otherwise, let the soul be soul. We deny it, we do not worry about it, but we behold it as if human beings had souls, as if the soul wanted to have an effect on all this. On all of this. This is a comfortable philosophy, but also terribly void of thought. Indeed, whoever tries to put this philosophy to use in tangible, practical life sees that this as-if philosophy is not much good, even as a method. A person such as Fritz Mautner, who wrote A Philosophy of Language and traced everything back to language, must be examined from the point of view of this as-if philosophy, as if such a person could also have spirit. But if we make this attempt, we find that this method is not much good. We do not say that we can be observed as if we had a spirit. It is not applicable. It is not applicable when no spirit is present. Of course, you know how I mean that. But I only mention this Fritz Mautner because he is someone who completely denies the whole significance of history, and who said most evidently from the standpoint of present materialism, that history can never be a science. He said that when a raindrop falls on the earth, one can discover the raindrop's laws scientifically because many raindrops fall according to the same laws. One can compare the individual cases with each other and then find the laws. Contemporary philosophers believe that observing many instances in which the same thing always occurs leads to individual laws. But things happen only once in history. The 30 Years' War happened only once, and so on. Thus, to Fritz Mautner, our entire history is only a series of accidents. People today must come to such conclusions if they truly deny spirit, because history would be only a series of coincidences if precisely what we just described, which has an effect from the spiritual world and which people between death and rebirth contribute to, did not affect history in a real way. We weave, as it were, between death and rebirth what happens here on earth. We weave only according to those impulses that come to us from the spiritual world. An objection cannot be seriously raised against spiritual science from any scientific perspective, because when we compare to spiritual science what today's science can truly accomplish, today's science is the best support for spiritual science. We must simply approach the subject in the correct way. If you take up any book today in which a materialistically minded person voices views, perhaps half psychologically and half physiologically, you will find the following. These people attempt to imagine how humans visualize things by showing the intellectual apparatus, the physical organs, the life of the nerves, the life of the brain. They test this intellectual apparatus and can really show that when some idea takes hold in us, a process takes place in the brain. Thus they claim they can prove to you that without a process in the brain, a thought or idea could not be conceived at all. Then what do you need an autonomous soul for? Only an intellectual apparatus is there. But they also come to something else, these materialistically minded people. Look through the usual textbooks, and you will find that in them, these people show the intellectual apparatus and connect all thinking and visualization with the mechanical processes in the brain and nervous system. But they must deny feeling and will. Feeling and will cannot be explained by bodily processes. Thus they are simply discarded. And today, when you open these books, you will find everywhere that although people have acquired will and feeling through their biases, these are in fact treated as non-entities, as if they do not exist at all. Thus, natural scientists stop short of feeling and will. As we now know, after death, thoughts separate themselves from us, along with the etheric body. This explains how the separated part, which leaves us along with the etheric body, also works on our exterior here on earth, and forms the intellectual apparatus. When the intellectual apparatus is formed, then thinking occurs with the help of the intellectual apparatus formed by thinking itself. Feeling and will remain with us in the astral body and the eye. We carry them into the spiritual world. Science does not force materialism on us. Quite the opposite. True science today justifies spiritual science all around. Today's materialism is completely dependent on people's having no inclination toward spiritual life, on their having no interest in or any appreciation for spiritual life. Understanding does not have to be missing either. Because truly, when we engage with what the spiritual scientist is able to give from the spiritual world, even for such a period as the life between death and rebirth, it can indeed be understood. We need only a finer, subtler understanding than the coarse understanding modern human beings employ, in many cases, for the outside world. But we also live in a time when materialism has just reached its high point. Spiritual scientists can, in fact, give the exact year in which materialism reached a high point, about 1840-1841. Since that time, it has already begun to recede somewhat, but there are, of course, major after effects. But this materialism, what does it mean for our concepts about physical human life? It is exactly the most astute minds of our time who are misleading people under the influence of materialism so lamentably, two lamentably gross misconceptions. There is a truly very astute man who is a criminal anthropologist by profession. He has analyzed many criminal brains. He proposed a well-known important theory on criminal brains, the theory that in most criminal brains, in the greatest number of cases, the posterior lobe which covers the cerebellum is underdeveloped, as is also the case with monkeys. Monkeys are distinguished precisely by the fact that they also have a small occipital lobe. That was, of course, grist for the mill, because one could say that when people are criminal, it is a regression to monkey nature. They are born with an occipital lobe that is too small. But think what an enormous consequence that must have for moral life, for people who say that humans have only a physical body. Then such people must say, quote, "What is all this responsibility you talk of? What do you mean you want to morally improve people through this or that educational method? It is all nonsense. Those born with an occipital lobe that is too small, which of course cannot grow over the cerebellum during this life, become criminals. Of necessity, they become criminals." Close quote. And then, if this materialistic thinking were realistic, it would also be true. We are not executing people because they have killed someone, but because their occipital lobes are too small. Materialists would have to admit this. They could not live in the world if they did not admit such a thing. People could not be materialistic in this sense at all if they did not admit that they would hang people because their occipital lobes are too small. Anything else would only cover up the truth. But is it the truth? We must speak of the etheric body of the deceased, as we have done today, in the sense that it is also still present. Of this etheric body, which actually expands after death and weaves itself into the general world order, into the general world ether. Now, if we have a young person whose occipital lobe is too small, we cannot just make it grow, because no physical science has accomplished that. But we can set up education in an appropriate manner when we see that there is also an etheric body present, and that part of the etheric body corresponds to the occipital lobe. We can develop the etheric body of the occipital lobe precisely through appropriate education. The etheric occipital lobe is just as effective in life, maybe even in a certain sense more effective, as the physical occipital lobe, because it must overcome a certain force. And the comfort then streams forth from our knowledge that the physical form of an occipital lobe is not the only thing that matters. Rather, if we notice those who have this or that disposition to do wrong, we can develop the etheric lobe of such people, whose occipital lobe is too small, by evoking specific feelings in them. Then we will be able to save them. You see, that is the truth. That is the moral aspect of spiritual science. It too is present. If people were honest, they would see desolation and dreariness arising from the materialistic worldview, specifically in moral ethical relationships. One can see arising from what spiritual science can give us the consoling possibility of actively engaging in what people become. If we can observe at the right moment certain tendencies in a child that could lead to criminal behavior, then we will be able, especially, to develop through a certain type of education the aspect of the etheric that affects the occipital lobe particularly strongly. Thus we could weave this strength into people, which then lives on with them between death and rebirth. This would develop the occipital lobe especially well, even into the physical nature in the next incarnation. We help them not only for this incarnation, we also create the disposition for an especially well-developed brain, which they can then carry through the life between death and rebirth to be incorporated in their next bodily incarnation. Thus, spiritual science engages us practically in life. But it will have to do something that goes beyond what people do today. People today think, much too much, that they have done enough with spiritual science if they listen to it for a while, and if they believe that it has a beneficial uplifting effect on the soul. That is not enough. Spiritual science must have practical application in all aspects of life. The fruits of spiritual science must come forth in all aspects of life. Pedagogy is especially bleak today because people believe only in what humans are physically. Pedagogy especially must be stimulated by spiritual science. Today there are still many people who say, quote, "Well, you can tell us a lot about spiritual science, but why should we believe what you tell us? We cannot see it ourselves." Close quote. At best, someone who finds the way, to a certain extent, into the spiritual worlds could see it as it is depicted in title How to Know Higher Worlds. But it is a totally egotistic point of view when people want, above all, to see something practical and believe that by looking at spirit in the same external way as they look at the physical, because they are too comfortable to search for spirit in a spiritual way, that this will somehow carry spirit into the physical world. And if materialism today is connected with egotism, it is, after all, a worldview, then materialistic spiritism is even more egotistic, because at least materialism goes about simply accepting only the physical world and then satisfying this physical world. Materialistic spiritism, however, tries to have first a sensory view of the spiritual world and second, perpetual satisfaction, and of a physical kind at that. But in its lack of clarity, this spiritism imagines the physical to be spiritual. In short, it wishes to remain in the physical world and yet also have a spiritual aspect. Deplorably, the increase in materialism, which is flourishing especially in America, has become possible through the popular spiritism that emerged there because of its tendency to materialize the spiritual, to present the spiritual aspect and spiritual events materially. But to return to the earlier thread, there are many ways to identify things on the physical plane as impressions of the spiritual world. And one of the ways, of course not all of them, can be mentioned here, is by seeking the spiritual where it is working, for instance, in children, where it should develop. Pedagogy must be stimulated there. Pedagogy will become living only if people reach the point of cultivating a sense of feeling for the spiritual, so that the teacher not only gives every kind of pedagogical instruction, but also, above all, is intent on observing the potential of the individuality to see what wants to develop from it. This must be achieved, really achieved. And we would do well to be aware, so that we can keep faith with this effort, that people in our time are actually incredibly short-sighted. They believe that we have come remarkably far in our time, that we have finally gotten rid of all the naivete of earlier centuries. But it is not true that we have gotten rid of biases. We had to get rid of the old atavistic clairvoyance, which was done away with in its last remnants not so very long ago, in order to see the physical plane clearly and to attain freedom. I spoke the day before yesterday to our dear friends in Hamburg about a particular example of this clairvoyance. If you were to look around, you might be able to find such an example here, too. I would like to tell you about the Hamburg example. Maybe you can look for a similar one yourselves in Kassel. When the fall from paradise, the powerful image in the Bible that stands for the seduction of humankind by Lucifer, is painted by an artist today, Adam and Eve and the serpent are depicted realistically. The serpent has a typical serpent's head. We know from spiritual science that this serpent is Lucifer. A physical serpent on earth can at most be a sort of symbol for Lucifer, but this physical serpent is not Lucifer. The long serpent that artists depict encircling a tree with a typical common serpent head on top is no Lucifer. Lucifer is a being who remained back at the moon stage of existence, a being who we, of course, cannot see with our senses. Seeing with the sense of sight did not occur during the moon stage. The earth has produced this sensory aspect. We see an earthly serpent with our senses. Of course, we cannot see Lucifer with our senses. We must look at him inwardly. When we look inwardly, it is an inner sensing, and we sense that the upper part has something similar to a human head with bulging eyes. Quote, "Your eyes shall be opened. You shall see," close quote. The serpent is inside the head and fills out the nervous system right down into the spinal cord. That is, a human head that continues into the body of the serpent. This, however, is all to be thought of only etherically. Thus it would have to be perceived out inwardly. A painter who wants to paint Lucifer, according to the Bible, would have to paint the etheric nature of the spinal cord. And above that, something that is still etheric, not yet physical, the human head. This is our lesson today, in an image. You can see Bible images by Meister Bertram, including the fall, as I have just described it, in Hamburg. He painted no ordinary serpent, rather a serpent with the usual form, but with a human head. In the 14th or 15th century, in the middle of the Middle Ages, artists could paint that way. That is, they still perceive the reality of the etheric realm. There you have tangible evidence of how things were at that time. Artists did not portray an ordinary serpent in those days because atavistic clairvoyance was still present. This capacity has disappeared completely over the last few centuries, and now it must be regained. It can be regained only by preparing ourselves to understand the spiritual world again through spiritual science. And so those who stand with spiritual science with their whole heart and whole soul see that the most important task of our time is to learn to understand what is in the spiritual world in order to prepare themselves to be able to look into the spiritual world, into what plays a part in the world around us. How differently we all go through the world, and not just the visible world. After all, light is not otherwise visible, colors are visible, when we know that air is not all that surrounds us, rather that the air is permeated by weaving forces, and the etheric bodies of the dead also weave within the light. Spiritual science will be there for all people. It will bring something to all people. Natural science and spiritual science will then be well connected. I believe it is exceptionally important in our time that we feel a strong commitment to allowing such truths as we have been able to experience today about the life between death and rebirth to enter into our meditation quite often. Another good content for meditation is to let the beginning of the life between death and rebirth, the emptiness that assigns us our place in the world, to let this assignment of the etheric world, this interweaving of our own etheric body into the etheric world, come before our soul quite often while meditating. Thus, what is within us will be stimulated to grow more and more into the immediate experience of the spiritual world. And humanity today really needs that. When you look at the events of our time, you can feel how important it is for humanity today to become part of the spiritual world. The present time of testing will be experienced in the right way only if a number of people can perceive faithfully and with devotion what is alive in spiritual science, and how spiritual science must prepare humanity's future. The signs of the times are truly grave, and this gravity reveals itself precisely when we think about what is close to us. Just think, we are talking about what should imbue our path with a serious principle. To seek what is alike among all human souls and throughout all nations and races. We rightly see this as a high ideal of humanity. But we must not conceal from ourselves what an immense contrast there is between life in present-day Europe and this ideal. Can we say that what European humanity expresses today is even remotely close to this ideal, to what it expresses? It is so far away from this ideal. And may I say specifically, may we then see this ideal as one we might put into practice immediately today? Are we not obligated as Germans to be clear, so that we do not fool ourselves, that given European relations today, we cannot even think of realizing such an ideal in the slightest? We would complete very poorly the mission ordained at us specifically as Germans if we simply got carried away today by general ambiguous ideals. Our times require us to unfold something specific within our central European being. And we may see this connected with the karma that has accrued especially for us. If you look at world events today, you will see that we have been guided rather well in the sense of these great world events. Karma brought about the fact that our movement was first part of the general theosophical movement. Long before this war showed what it could teach the German people today, our German movement completely separated, broke away from the theosophical movement. We have emphasized how important it is that our spiritual movement, which carries us and which will also have to carry the spiritual world, grows specifically from the qualities of the German people. We could say that we, as the anthroposophical movement, have already for years felt the hatred of, especially the British, toward our specific field of spiritual science. It is simply increased now, because they cannot remain silent there. What has recently been written about us on the part of the so-called English theosophists exceeds anything forgivable. Thus, if we look over the course of our movement, we can well say that we also find our karma somehow through our own movement, that it is in complete harmony with what the great movement in the outside world shows us today. Because our karma led us early enough to an independent emphasis on German spiritual life, we may certainly, in all modesty, make karma out to be favorable to us. And we may regard the fact that anthroposophy found its center in German spiritual life as a sort of luminous morning star for our karmic stream. And since the signs of what is now taking place outside in the world appeared to us much earlier, we can derive the belief from this one single fact, that there is something in our movement that has a power for the great general movement of humanity. Let us learn, my dear friends, to trust that the spiritual force latent in our movement is among the best our souls could possibly join with. Let us learn to experience the whole gravity, the whole meaning of thought and feeling and the will impulse, and the whole meaning of the fact that there must be individual souls who understand in relation to the great challenges of our time how spiritual impulses must cooperate with what will play out in our future history here on earth. Let us learn to understand, not just in the abstract, but also in the concrete sense, what meaning and significance the countless dead now flooding the earth have. Let us learn to understand that we must remain faithful to our movement, so that there will be people who can correctly look into the sphere in which the etheric bodies of those who have sacrificed themselves for our time will continue to play a part on the great fields of history and cooperate with those who will walk the earth later in times of peace. Let us learn to understand what it means to find the correct meaning, so that spirituality permeates even what is taking place today on the physical plane, so that followers of spiritual science will give meaning to what arises spiritually from the courage and sacrifice of our time. Let us learn to understand the correct meaning of the words from which we now close, with which we now close these reflections. From the combatant's courage, from the blood of battle, from the suffering of those abandoned, from the people's sacrificial death, spiritual fruit will grow. May souls guide their senses, conscious of spirit, into the realm of the spirits. The end of Lecture 2.